Welcome to So Hot Right Now. I'm Tom Mustill.
And I'm Lucy Siegel.
In the global scramble to get the message out about nature and climate emergencies, we must use everything at our disposal. Celebrity is a powerful tool to bring attention to global problems, but powerful tools have to be used right.
In this episode, we access all areas. We slip behind the red VIP rope and we turn the red carpet green as we unwrap celebrity climate activism with one of the UK's biggest selling music stars ever, Ellie Goulding.
Whoa!
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
There's been a lot of debate about this over the years, but the celebrity environmental activist is not a new phenomenon. If you think about Robert Redford, who set up Sundance in 1980, which is now credited as being one of the first meetings of celebrity and environmentalism. Band Aid was in 1984, leveraging global superstars to raise money and bring attention to the global hunger crisis. Now, the power and daily reach of A-listers has been cemented by the rise of social media. Polling shows that globally 72% of internet users aged 16 to 24 years use social networks to keep up with and follow celebrities. Imagine Greta Thunberg without social media.
So the theory is that if you can get that A-lister to talk nature and climate, and if that comes from them and is their passion, that will be a winner.
Or is it more complicated? You've been working with celebrities for a long time.
I have, yes. So initially, I'll tell you why I did that initially, and it was because I wanted to try and get over the sort of stigma, the hair shirt, preachy stigma that environmentalism had at the time. And there was undeniable appeal of the, some of the celebrities around when I first started doing this, like Leonardo DiCaprio, Natalie Portman. Can I tell you, Woody Harrelson came into our office once and he was such a hardcore environmentalist compared to everyone else. And he went to the bathroom and he came back with the soap dispenser, which he'd taken off the wall, which he objected to. He was fuming. He objected to it because it was a non-reusable plastic insert from a main brand. And he said, you guys have got to sort your shit out, essentially. And then when it was time for Woody to leave, he was in a show in the West End in the theatre. He was trying to get the bus because he refused to like get in a taxi because he thought it was really ungreen.
It is.
And I ended up having to drive him in a electric vehicle that I had on loan.
No way.
Which was the only thing that he would go in. And he was brilliant because we were quite late by that point and he was stopping traffic on the Farringdon Road, like leaning out. He's wearing a beanie and it was like, Woody, everyone could see it was Woody.
You were Woody Harrelson's green hype chauffeur.
I was.
That is so cool.
It was the greatest day of my
life.
That
is amazing. So that's pretty cool. But does it work?
Yes, I think so, as long as they really mean it. And the thing about Woody was he really meant it. And now there isn't a huge amount of evaluation, but there's a study, for example, from 2017 that looks at the effectiveness of celebrity marketing and conservation. And that basically concludes that the famous person has to live and breathe it. So you can't just parachute in a famous face. And I think from the activist or organiser's point of view, the thing that a celebrity can bring is also a great team and resource and the expert in the entertainment industry. So it can be like rocket fuel,
right,
in my experience.
So if a famous person decides to speak out about nature and climate, it can be pretty risky. Right? Because in the age of cancel culture, if you stick your head up and talk about issues you care about, maybe you're going to, piss people off and provoke a backlash. You know, there's trolls. Sometimes you can say the wrong thing or phrase it in the wrong way. And you can look like a hypocrite because, you're flying around the world. Obviously, often you've got loads of money doing those things in the system that we're in often means that you're contributing or look like you're contributing to the problems.
maybe that's why so many of them don't say anything at all.
Yeah.
It's not completely straightforward. It is not completely straightforward. And also, what is it like to raise your head above the parapet when you're in that position?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard enough to get celebrity anyway. I guess if you've like worked all your life to be really, really good at a part of entertainment, you know, maybe you feel like you've done enough. Maybe you feel like you don't want to maybe like tread on a mine trying to talk about an issue that's maybe not something you deal with every day, even though you might really care about it. It must be scary. So,
well, shall we find out?
Yeah, let's find out.
So to find out on So Hot Right Now, we decided to talk to one of the UK's most successful music artists and longtime activist for the planet, Ellie Goulding. Firstly, let's just quantify her reach. I want to do that X Factor voice, but I can't.
First,
do it.
Let's quantify her reach.
Okay, well, you can do the next bit then.
So far, she's had 2 number one albums, 2 Brit Awards, sold over 15 million albums, 132 million singles. Her 4th album, Brighter Blue, will be released on the 17th of July. Whoa, that's a lot. I remember listening to Starry Eyes when I had starry eyes as a youngster, having a very nice time, and it was pretty exciting.
Paul Oakenfold remix.
No, you know what? Not the Paul Oakenfold. I interviewed Paul Oakenfold once.
Did you?
I did.
For what?
I was doing a mini film about DJs, and I filmed quite a few DJs. But you know what? I think that's a story for another time.
Sorry, I have a DJ obsession.
Really? So. Carl Cox, he was amazing. Yeah. I love Carl Cox.
He's the first to use 3 decks.
Oh, mate. Carl Cox, he was just... Yeah, it was at the Amsterdam Dance Event, which is like a giant concrete hangar.
We need a different podcast for this. We can still call it So Hot Right Now, but we'll just talk about
DJs. Yeah, it's about how sweaty you were when you interviewed a DJ. So, back to Ellie. On social media, she's amassed 22 billion streams. Oh my God, that's insane.
These are real numbers,
Tom. Real numbers. Okay, she's surpassed 10 million subscribers on YouTube. So that's 5 billion views globally. Her social media platforms give her a combined following of over 33 million followers. Oh my days. That's pretty big. I actually didn't realize it. She was that big when we interviewed her. I'd have been much more embarrassed and scared if I'd known that.
We kept a lid on it. And if that wasn't enough, we've got a second expert for you. Todd Krim is a celebrity charity fixer from Los Angeles. So he matchmakes A-listers with agencies and activists to get climate stories off the ground. So this episode also includes a quick fire round with Todd when we pick his brains.
And we got to speak to Ellie and Todd just before the lockdown in London, where you could meet people and talk to them face to face. Do you remember those days?
I remember them so fondly. That was the last time that we were together.
It was.
You and me, Tom, and Natalie.
IRL. When do you think we'll see each other IRL ever again?
I've just worked out what IRL means.
What did you think it was? What was your instinct?
I don't think so, Tom.
Oh, okay. I guess that's it.
I bloody hope so.
I hope so.
Also, I need to give you this microphone kit.
Yeah, that's what I meant. That's what I'm looking forward to seeing.
We'll begin with Miss Ellie Goulding. Here she is. So this episode of So Hot Right Now is about being popular, isn't it?
Yes, Tom. Yes, you're looking at me, but I'm not an expert in being popular.
No, but you'd like to be, wouldn't you?
I think so. I think I've given up, but we have a very popular person here. God, is that a segue? I don't know. I've not done
that. That is a segue.
Great.
Welcome, Ellie Goulding, to So Hot Right Now.
Thanks, guys.
It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this, which I often do. Let's just have a disclaimer. We've worked together on many a climate thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are old hands at the climate stuff.
Less of the old.
Sorry. Really?
Poor Tom has to walk on eggshells anywhere around me because there's so many sensitivities when you're working with a perimenopausal hack.
Professional badasses at this. Is that okay? Asses?
Yes.
Okay.
We can swear, can't we?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah, we encourage it, don't we? It may be. I don't know. Will that make us more popular?
Not with my mum.
Swearing is cool, apparently.
Oh, that's such a definitive statement.
I think swear words are very important.
That's why it adds apparently.
Does your mum not swear?
No, she does, but she doesn't like gratuitous swearing or gratuitous nudity or gratuitous violence.
My mum loves all of those things.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I'm more like your mum.
Yeah. Okay. Ellie, you are not only a global superstar, which I literally have written down here, you are also a UN environment ambassador, and you're known, you've got actually a long history now in what I would call senior climate interventions, in that you've spoken at the UN, you take on world leaders. I mean, you're pretty sort of fearless.
I'm just getting started, Lucy. No, I've had to, honestly, I'm going to be really honest, I've had to put it slightly on the back seat in the past year, as you kind of know, because I've been finishing my fourth album, which has been quite a process, not only trying to make sure that everything, all the packaging, is eco-friendly, but also just from an artistic point of view, they've had a nightmare with me figuring out what I want on the album. It's like pulling off limbs. It's like wanting one song, but then not another, but actually those two songs go quite well together. So I've had to really, it's been a struggle. I've had to really put it aside to make way for finishing this album, because I think the one thing I always said that I wouldn't do was mix the two. So, for example, writing a song about how much I care about the environment wouldn't necessarily happen. But I've realised that in the language on the new album, I've realised it's kind of in there anyway. It's just kind of become part of my songwriting. Because suddenly you realise, oh my God, I've got this opportunity for people to listen to these songs that are catchy, and they'll listen to them perhaps more than once. And suddenly you realise you can talk about something and people might actually listen. If you use colourful enough lyrics and, you're quite forward and open, that's kind of how you get people's attention, I've realised.
That's so interesting. Like, did you consider them sort of separate worlds before?
I consider them, like, I was really quite, I was going to say aggressive, but people would always say, oh, are you going to write a song about the weather? Or, you know,
and they do it in that voice.
I mean, and I did. I'd go on Sesame Street and
You went on
sing,
Sesame Street?
I did, and I sang a song called Thank You Clouds about how they water the plants, and
which I love that song.
Thank you, clouds. I can't remember the rest. Help that you can't remember the rest. Anyway, but that was probably the closest I came to doing a song about the weather. But I think I was just conscious that I had, in my history of seeing protesters, activists who were also artists, they were given such a bad reputation immediately for being involved in any kind of activism, or it just didn't really have a good reputation. Mm-hmm. To suddenly go out there and be getting involved in Racing Extinction or just protesting in general was kind of not known to be, it just wasn't cool. And naturally I was really protective over my job, because, you know, I've created my job entirely by myself.
Yeah.
It's my livelihood, it's my everything, it's how I make money. I think people have realised it's my career.
And you employ a lot of people.
I employ a lot of people, what I do affects not just me, but a lot of people, my fans. And so I was really conscious to begin with not to merge the two and keep my activism really separate.
Because you thought that the activism would jeopardise your job?
I genuinely thought the activism would jeopardise my job, and I believe it has, actually.
Oh, tell me.
Well, I lose followers every time I post anything about climate change. I lose at least 1,000 followers.
Even now?
Yep.
Why do you think that is?
Because people are following me for a very specific reason, and it's not the environment. Occasionally people will private message me, DM me and say, wow, I had no idea, thank you so much for educating us about that. Or I'll have people say, fuck you for posting this, we don't want to hear this. This is not what we're interested in. Stop preaching, climate change isn't real. So I've had to be careful, and it's really difficult. And I think that's why there is a lack of artists speaking out about it, because they're just terrified for their job. And I get that, I understand that. I think people are just worried that it's going to affect their career. And I think we can all be honest and say that it probably has affected some people's careers. When you think of someone, you don't think, oh, an amazing singer. Like, if they, you know, it can overpower, you know, the thing that got them there in the first place. I don't know, something like that. That was the mentality behind it.
But do you feel that I mean, you've been involved in like sort of climate and environmental advocacy for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's kind of a bit cooler now. But
yeah, it's so frustrating because it was never cool.
Yeah.
There were two things that weren't cool when I started out. That was, for some reason, protesting and being an activist just weren't cool, like 10 years ago, not in my industry. And then the other thing was running was I when I first won like the Brit sound, you know, I won like the BBC sound poll. I won like the Brit Award for newcomer, best new artist, whatever. And my promo video was running in a park because I loved running and I loved nature. And I remember everyone, you know, music blogs, people just being like, oh my God, what a massive dork, you know, not a rock star.
Really?
Yeah. And I remember being really offended by it and really sad about it because I just liked running to the point where I said to whenever we had a meet and greet, I'd be like, well, let's go on a run because it's we're doing something, we're achieving something, but we get to chat and it sort of stops the awkwardness of sitting in a room and signing things for like, hi, nice to meet you, and just being weird. But for years, it was so un-rock and roll, and now everyone's bloody doing it. Mm. And it's just, it's cool now to be, you know, there's so many like Instagram influencers, like fitness influencers, now everyone's on it. It's the same with like protesting. And you know, if people are doing it now to be cool, then great. You know, it's perhaps not the right thing, but I'd rather people be doing it than not.
I think with being cool, as someone who's never been cool.
You're very cool, I think. You're cooler than you think you are.
Yes, I think that's really...
And your shirt's really cool as well.
I think that's really true.
Okay, great.
You're so uncool, you're cool.
Yeah.
I'm a bit lost for words, but...
That was a very backhanded compliment by moi.
Yeah, I'll just take anything. That's brilliant. Thank you both.
Tom's gone really red.
Yeah.
But I guess a lot of people who want to be cool might have been into those, or just don't want to be called out for being uncool, but might have been into like those kinds of things. It takes a trailblazer or someone to stick their head above the parapet and a bunch of people to join in, like with the protests and with running. I think, isn't like running the... It's only 1 in 6 people in the States now run or something. Mm.
In the States?
Yeah.
Really?
I think, look, I'll check that later, but I saw a film about it recently and it's just exploded with the number of people. And a part of that is nature connection as well.
Yeah. There's people releasing books about I mean, there's writers, there's journalists, like people writing, you know, entire blogs and books on how running has literally saved their life.
Mm. Liam Gallagher, he runs now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard that as well.
Lots of old ravers running. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good way of like squeezing the old serotonin glands.
Yes, we won't say how that was squeezed previously, but yes, it's...
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Let's move on.
But I think, do you think it's also about like that we had a kind of much... It feels like there's an openness about talking about emotions, maybe especially around mental health and it being okay to have a problem that is living in a big industrialized, aggressive, macho culture, and that being around nature and running and being okay talking about that is kind of part of that sort of the edge of what's cool kind of softening a bit.
You know, I used to admittedly be a bit preachy about reconnecting with nature. I felt like it was the most important thing for people to do to understand you know, why people like me, why people like Lucy are so passionate about saving the environment. And just, you know, you just have to go into it for an hour and get off your phone and really understand what's you know, at stake. But then I realised that people who grew up in the city don't have the same connection to nature, but, you know, in that kind of inherent thing where you grow up having just this you know, I crave it. I like crave being in the countryside. I crave driving out of London and in my eco car, by the way, my BMW i3. It's like something. It's like an addiction. It's like something I need. So it's really easy for me to have that kind of passion inside. Whereas, I don't know what it's like for people who really grew up in urban places. So I don't know.
Well, I grew up in suburbia mainly, and that's a different sort of nature. So I became very obsessed with garden birds, for example, which is definitely not cool. But
I love garden birds.
Yeah. In fact, Kaz, our mutual friend, who we now all know, Kaz, I was talking to her actually at your birthday party about birds, and I'd obviously gone on a bit long, and she just looked at me and she said, I'm not as into birds as you are, Lucy. So I get that a lot. But the idea, for me, just going back to what Tom was saying before about needing a trailblazer, it felt to me when I first started seeing you at Climate Stuff that you were so driven because of your connection with nature that you almost couldn't help yourself. Like all of the industries going, don't talk about this, don't talk about this. And you were like, no, I need to talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it felt like you were being propelled by something like within you.
Yeah.
Because I think like where you're from rural Herefordshire, is probably the closest that we have to sort of wilderness in the UK.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it's a more extreme version of nature than I grew up with, for sure. And you kind of knew every hedgerow and blah, 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 because you used to walk everywhere. Before you can drive in those places, you have to walk everywhere.
Yeah.
And you know the landscape really, really well.
Yeah.
And I just felt like that was completely like in you.
Yeah. I mean, like, I didn't go into it, you know, when I first met with the UN, I didn't pretend to know things, to be well researched and to understand what was going on in the world and to understand the science. But I think the main thing was, yeah, I had that passion, and you know, my love for the natural world was enough for them to think that I was you know, the right person to take on that role.
Well, one of the things they've said quite openly at the UN and other places, like, help us communicate, because you know, actually, you were very reticent at the start because you didn't want people to think that you knew what you were saying, that you knew what you were talking about. But you're very good at humanising the science. So, for example, we went to Davos to the Arctic Base Camp, Ellie and I, and Professor Gail Whiteman from Lancaster University heads up a whole team of scientists there, Arctic scientists, basically, who sleep on the side of a mountain because they can't afford the hotel rates in Davos. And they basically just collar any world leader that comes past, drag them in and basically tell them about what's happening to the climate. And
so cool.
Yeah. So cool. tell me what that was like and how you think that we can get those messages out in a way that resonates with your fans, for example.
I mean, I think the language is just, it is a bit scary. And I think that's one of the reasons why people unfollow, because they don't, it is too scary for people to process. Seeing that, I mean, was so badass, and she kind of became like a new hero, because that was literally like dragging people up and sort of talking about data and things like that. But that was a way of making it interesting. Like, reading data is boring, right? It is a bit boring. To someone who knows about, first of all, understands that it's happening, that the Earth is warming up. But then seeing like shitloads of data, it's certainly not something my fans would. Look, maybe I'm underestimating them, but I know just from past attempts that data does not appeal to people. So it's then I think it's just getting people to it's stories, and I think that's going back to songwriting is that I love hearing stories myself. I think we all love hearing stories. It's just part of us. Even gossiping, it's just like. Gossiping's not great, but we all like a little gossip, right? Every so often.
I never gossip.
I mean, if you define gossip as just wanting to talk about other people, it'd be pretty weird not to do it and to be interested in other humans and what they choose to do in their lives.
But I think with Davos, it was a combination of being there as well, because, you know, being there and being in it and just being around them. And I was in a particularly foul mood that day for some reason. I don't know why. I think I had quite bad anxiety, so the idea of going and being in front of a bunch of cameras, I just was just foul mood, you know. I just really didn't want to speak to anyone, and I was so uplifted by meeting all the scientists. But I think that's another issue, is that people are unable to see things or be in places or feel things or Even like going and seeing the, going down to Cambridge and, you know, seeing the sea life that, you know, the that only survive in super, super cold waters. You know, just picking those up and feeling them, and kind of just being in it. I mean, that I think that's enough for anyone, you know, even the biggest climate denier, even just to have that connection with nature, like, does something. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really difficult to preach about stuff when, you know, when also a majority of people can't afford to travel or go to other countries or just be in it, you know.
But then you can go to lots of things, you can experience lots of things and not actually engage with it properly. Mm. So, sorry, I don't want to talk about an incident when Tom wasn't there and no one else was there, but back to the Davos thing, I remember one of the things that you did was to drag in a sort of mutual friend of ours, Lucy, who was quite heavily pregnant at the time.
Yeah.
And you were like, come and just hold this ice core.
Oh, yeah.
And you were like explaining the story of it. So that's when that's what I mean. I heard you explain the story of the ice core and the trapped CO2 in the ice core, but in a way that didn't mention CO2.
Yeah.
So that for me is what you're very, very good at.
It doesn't sound like preaching.
Well, I had a good prop because it was you could hear, mm-hmm. you could hear the CO2 fizzling out as it was melting. But that, I think that is just, that is absolutely fascinating. And so it's more things like that, I suppose, because I think that we just kept getting fed pictures of disasters and, you know, the horrible fires in Australia and then, you know, the Amazon, the polar bears and, you know, the Arctic on fire and things like that. And it's just the doom and gloom thing is it just doesn't work with people's brains.
You don't think?
But when I think of...
I don't, when I see that even as an activist, I just think, oh, scroll on.
When I think of other movements, like the civil rights movement, and I think of the music as being an integral part of those times. Yeah. And I don't think, when I think about it, that the songs that come to mind, they're not fact-laden sort of information songs. They're emotional stories about people.
Mm. Yeah.
And often about future worlds that the people would like to have.
Yeah. You know, you're so right. I learned so much from Forrest Gump because it was the first time I'd heard some of those songs, and it was in the, you know, one of the most important times in America, and it goes through all those times. It tells, you know, you know, through the world of Forrest Gump, but you know, the Vietnam War and you know, even the, you know, when he's going running and everyone's following him, and
with the muddy t-shirt
with the smiley face, and then, you know, shit happens, he treads in dog shit. I learned so much from that film, weirdly. I didn't know anything about the Vietnam War. I didn't know anything about protests. You know, I think John Lennon's in it at one point. Didn't know anything about the Beatles. Weirdly, learned a lot from that film.
Yeah.
It's not weird, songs. Though, is it? Because it's a great film and it pulls all those levers. It's like...
But it wouldn't be... I don't know if it would be the same without the music. The music mm-hmm. was so poignant and so important in that.
Yeah, I was really sad when Leonard Cohen died recently, and I listened to loads of his music and I realised how much of it, you know, starting off with World War II... I think partisan songs, and going through like songs about what was happening in the United States with the various movements there, and then in his later life, like his spiritual feelings, like, and it's so emotional. And now when I think of those themes, I think of his songs.
Yeah. You know, I write things down all the time, and I, especially when I'm drunk, and especially if I'm traveling, there's something about being on a train or just being in any kind of motion that makes you think more. Like I posted a picture the other day where I said I'm pretending to be in a music video, and you're looking out the window in the rain, and you're just, you know, pretending that someone's filming you. I think it's like a I don't know, viral thing. I write things down all the time, and then but today in kind of today's music world, everything is about how many streams you can get of a song, which means that over the past few years, there's this kind of fight to get the most catchy, viral. The charts have changed massively. So you're not hearing like the whimsical, guitar-y, you know, lyrical stories anymore necessarily. Mm. You're hearing stuff that's a lot more nursery rhymey. It's a lot more designed for things like viral videos, like TikTok, right?
Oh, right. So a snippet can just be nicked and used as a backing for something else.
Yeah, people have made a bit, small piece of music, 10-second piece of music, put it on TikTok, done a dance routine, and then the song goes so, the video goes so viral, like millions and millions of views, that then they make a song out of that snippet, which then becomes a hit. And that's kind of the new world of like popular music. Like for example, like K-pop has become really big recently. The bands are just huge. If I mention BTS in anything, it will instantly get like 100,000 likes on Twitter. Songwriting is still there, and people are still writing those beautiful songs about their experiences and how they feel about the world. And you know, Björk singing about like some kind of utopia or some kind of futuristic thing. But will those songs be heard as much? Not necessarily by young people. There might be still like solid fan bases there, but it's just a shame that those songs perhaps won't get
But
as
you
much.
you got the last number one of the decade with a Joni Mitchell
that
cover,
was
which
a bit
was
of an anomaly,
a
I
folk,
think.
Which was a folk song.
Which is a bit of an anomaly. But when I get given the task of singing, for example, 10 years ago I sang a John Lewis song. I did a cover of Elton John. I don't know what it is about me doing covers, but people bloody love them. And I don't know whether it's because when I sing covers, I can really easily somehow through my voice, like emulate or recreate whatever world they were in when they wrote it.
It's an atmosphere.
It's like acting. It's like when I sing my own songs, I'm so self-conscious of like what I'm singing about that perhaps it doesn't come across in the right way, or maybe I'm not performing it well enough. I don't know.
Some of them have done quite well. So
some of them have done all right. I mean, but
Delirium wasn't. I don't know how many.
But you know, singing a song about. I mean, look, Joni makes it easy because there is not one thing in that song that I would not have wanted to sing and try and feel about her skating away on a river. It's just such beautiful imagery. Yeah, that seemed to resonate with people. And then when I sang your song, I sang a completely different version. Like it was not anything like the original. And it just kind of worked. And I, in fact, you know, How Long Will I Love You? I did for a film a few years back. That was a cover. Damn, who did the original? I'm going to get absolutely slaughtered for this.
I'll look it up because I can't
remember. How long will I love you? Damn it, who was the original? I'm so sorry, I'm just having a brain fart.
I can't
right
remember
now.
Anything at the moment, so.
Yeah,
brain.
I like go.
The Water Boys.
I go to scroll. The Water Boys,
was
yeah.
Was it really? I thought it was much earlier than The Water Boys. No, it was. Oh, okay.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas. As law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed, 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
So with your music now, I mean, I guess we all just want the climate problems to go away so we don't have to sing about it and it doesn't have to be part of our lives. But do you feel that because it's not like something people haven't heard of anymore that's on the periphery, that it makes more sense to be part of your music?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it does. But I really fear for young people because not only are they completely overwhelmed with information about climate change and what's going on the planet, and not just climate change at the moment, but other mad shit as well. Pandemic and you know, I think American politics keeps creeping in, and you know, the sort of Brexit aftermath, and young kids, like they're absorbing information the most, you know, that their brains are just taking in all this stuff, so then they switch on the radio and it's like they're bloody singing about it. So it's, I'm like, oh, do I just keep making songs for people to enjoy the way that songs have kind of always been? And I think the key is maybe you can still write those lyrics and still, you know, Christine the Queens does it really well. She writes like great electro pop songs, but the lyrics are really, you know, she's super smart. Mm. And she writes these, you know, really beautiful lyrics about all kinds of things. If you haven't heard of her, I'm sure you have, but she's this French delight called Christine the Queens, and she's an incredible dancer.
She's amazing.
Yeah, so there is a way of doing it.
Yeah,
it can be quite clever.
It can't be forced, right? It has to you don't want to do a token song or a song that you wouldn't have otherwise wanted to make sing. It has to be, that's not inspiration, that's obligation.
Yeah.
But do you think that there might be more inspiration about this the more it's just part of everyone's lives?
Well, there's definitely a lot of music to come. I think maybe, I know a lot of people in the studio. I know that, I think the past year, especially has probably been very inspirational. So I'm curious to see what music will sort of look like in the next few years. I think honestly this past year it's been so madly turbulent that, you know, who knows, maybe people are going to start. I mean, people have started already. I know the 1975 are quite vocal about things and other bands. About many things.
Anyway.
Yeah. but yeah, so I'm curious. I'm curious to see where music keeps going. It's like we're all kind of, everyone in the music industry is kind of just waiting to see where it's going to go.
When are you allowed to talk about what's on your new album? In terms of, you can talk quite obliquely because I'll get killed by your management if we reveal anything. But in terms of this crossover where you have felt like you maybe wanted to put in some of these themes or write about these themes, have you done that on some songs?
There's definitely a sense of the world is ending, but it's okay. Which sounds awful and sounds so depressing, but in a sense that I use the sentence maybe because we're doomed, we're whole, as like the kind of sentence for kind of inspired most of the album. It's about maybe there's this world where this kind of crisis, this doom and gloom, is making everyone in some weird way look out for themselves a bit more and love themselves a bit more and focus less on kind of superficial stuff and superficial relationships. So it's mostly about becoming a woman and realizing that you can have so much love for yourself and you can do things by yourself and you can have that independence, because I've had a history of not being, feeling like I've always had to rely on somebody else for my own happiness and my own safety. So it's about breaking free from that. And it's, I always think to, when I used to watch, be obsessed with the piano, about with Jane, is it Jane Campion film, where she wants to be taken down into the ocean with her, the album's called Brightest Blue, but there's a very blue theme, it's a very kind of water theme. And that vision of her just being cut free, it all sounds very dark, but it's more sort of like it goes back to what my old album was called, which is Delirium, like a sense of like everything's kind of fucked, but we're feeling sort of whole from it. It's quite, it's I don't know. It's like everything's screwed, so let's just like be in this trance of you know, pretending everything's beautiful. I don't know,
or trying
like
to pretend you can control something and just beating yourself up about it. You know, it sounds really nuanced.
It sounds like radical hope, which is, you know, there's a it's almost like an instinctive thing, isn't it? Like however bad things get, you're gonna instinctively have hope, because what else can we do?
It is a very hopeful, you know, it's, I even say the line, like, don't worry about the future, you know, there's a blue evolution, which is like this kind of, it's me trying to create some other planet again. And, you know, I read a few articles about my music in the past. They say, like, it always sounds like she's trying to make, you know, music from some other world. Because my voice, you know, it can sort of get to that frequency where it's just...
ethereal.
Yeah, ethereal. I always get ethereal. I don't know, like it sort of maybe helps people go into this other world. So I don't know, it's, we'll see. I've no idea how people are going to react to it, but it's still a pop record, it's still like catchy. But it's interesting because there's two sides. One is written entirely by me, and then the other side is big Max Martin pop bangers. And
he's,
two
he's
very
the Swedish
different.
Guy. We should just explain who
he's
he
sort
is.
Of like pop's super god, if that's a thing. He's just idolized by entire music industry for just being able to create like these mathematically formulate pop songs that just can't not do well because they're designed to be massive.
But a lot of people used to work with him and not admit that they'd work with him.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think it's because the assumption is that if you go to them, it's because you need like a big banger. But I feel like we have some kind of affinity. Like I've worked with them for years since Love Me Like You Do, and we just get on really well. And they're all totally mental, and so am I. And it just like works really well.
But it's so interesting, isn't it? Because it's exactly this kind of algorithm that he's kind of created. It's exactly what we need for climate communications.
Yeah.
We also need to speak to Max Martin, don't we?
We need to speak to Max. Yeah. It's creating something that where people can't. That people sort of
engage
and how you know and feel like there's no other option.
So you're coming to people on their terms as
well. Sounds very dictatorial.
It's the opposite for me because you're accepting like what people want, how they think, how there's an evolution in the way that people listen to music. And you were talking about it before with the really short phrases and what goes on TikTok and what they can disseminate, because it's all about they're using the music to communicate, aren't they, within their circles.
And
I think you're acknowledging that evolution, and you're putting your not spin on it, but you're doing your thing, and you're also acknowledging that that's the evolution of it.
Yeah.
So it's for me, it's a mixture of a sort of pragmatic understanding of how people listen, because there's no point us creating anything, whether it's climate messaging or music, if no one's going to fucking listen to it, is there?
It's just navel gazing.
Well, what's the point of it?
Yeah, that's the thing. For example, I started making classical music, but I knew that because all I really listen to is classical music at the moment.
What are you listening to at the moment?
Classical. Yeah. So for example, I had Ola J-Lo play at my just do the entire music for my wedding. In fact, I'd love to host a classical show on up and coming composers and how they can really help they can help everything. I think listening to classical music it does wonders for your health.
There's a composer that I found the other day, a really young girl, and she to me a young woman, and she does compositions all around climate change.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I have to find her name. I'll remember her name.
Obviously, there was that really iconic viral video with an Audi playing on a piece of ice in the Arctic, elegy for the Arctic. That was beautiful. What was I saying? But it's like being a pop artist, which is sort of the pigeonhole that I've ended up in because I've released a lot of pop songs, and that's my fault. Now I'm in that world and I can't really go back. You can't release a big banger and then start releasing indie records and expect people
please don't stop releasing big bangers.
I love big bangers and I love big pop records. And my voice could have gone anywhere. My voice could have been, you know, weaved into any kind of music, but I chose pop because I love pop and I grew up listening to pop music. I didn't grow up listening to Dylan or Joni Mitchell or the Beatles or Rolling Stones even. I discovered all of that in my teens, but I grew up listening to pop and rave and dance and all that stuff, so that's just what I like to make, and it just so happens that it's like popular music that is heard on the radio. And
rave is the most the highest form of music, in my opinion.
Love rave.
It's the deepest form of connection.
Well, I certainly
I've definitely felt the most connections.
I mean, every day I hear songs and I hear new producers when I'm not, you know, stuck in Classic FM. And I send them just bits of vocal for them to just use. Recently Fortet just used my voice to do a track. I'm not crediting, it's not like featuring Ellie Goulding, but I just, a lot of producers will use my voice and just sort of weave it into whatever they're doing, and yeah.
So in terms of the other stuff that you do and the, you know, the big climate speeches you've done, how do you feel about those now?
About
talking about climate and giving speeches and being at these like huge high profile events where you've got like 10 world leaders in the front row.
It's really scary. That's like absolutely not natural. And I hate, as you know, because we worked together for a long time, I hate public speaking.
You're good at it though.
And I don't think I'm good at like spontaneous I get really flustered when there's something I want to say, but I can't say it in the right way. And that's why language is so important and having a bigger vocabulary. And that's why I'm always reading fiction. And every time I see a new word, I look it up. And I literally do that every day because I'm always trying to expand language. That's so important, especially when you're trying to describe your music or trying to describe, you know, even climate language. So when I've got something written, there's something takes over me, and I just do it, and I speak as clearly and as passionately as I. I mean, it's just kind of natural, isn't it?
Well, like singing a cover, like you kind of inhabit it when it's there.
But you know, I haven't done it for a while. I'm due another one, I think, at some point. I don't know when.
Because you've stuck your head above the parapet and you have been brave and used your position as a person who's in popular culture to talk about things you think are important, how do you deal with the trolls and how do you deal emotionally when people like aren't nice about it?
I've had trolls for as long as I can remember. People saying not very nice things about me, but it genuinely doesn't bother me. And I don't know whether that's because I'm very comfortable in myself. I've watched a few videos of me singing recently. I'm like, oh, I'm singing all right these days. And I'm happy in myself. I feel quite happy that I'm sticking to like a good routine of eating really well. I've got really into biohacking, but that's a whole other podcast.
Right.
I'm just feeling kind of confident. And I think I did a panel on mental health the other day in the music industry. And I said it was really important to acknowledge feeling good. Because I think there's definitely a sense that, oh, this person's just admitted finally that they're a bit depressed, or this person I look up to has said that they've had anxiety for this amount of time. This person just come forward and said this. Should I be? Am I depressed? You know. And I think it's really important now that everyone's speaking up. That you don't just have to speak up about feeling a bit shit. You can also speak up and say, look, I'm feeling really confident, I'm feeling really good right now. So that's important because it just means that it's not just like, okay, I don't have a right to talk about how I'm feeling because I'm not depressed, you know. So at the moment I see things, when people say things to me on social media, I find it genuinely funny. I've seemed to have developed quite a good relationship with it. I genuinely feel bad for people who take it, who really, really take it on board. And, you know, when people saying not very nice things, you know, even some of my fans will say, like, we don't like the last few songs you've released. And I'm like, well, that's
done
just
now.
Your opinion. And, you know, and also I have this recalibration thing now where I've taught myself to do it, which is, as soon as I go to reply to someone or say something, I think about it for a second. I think, do I really need to do that? No, I absolutely don't need to do that. Or I say to people, before you say something, you know, is your opinion that important? We all have a really important opinion. All our opinions are important, but are they that important? No, they're not. You know, and I feel really strongly about that. And that social media has made us think that our opinions are incredibly important, and suddenly everyone can have a say about something. But is giving your opinion on this thing? Is it a good point? Is it well informed? Have you read lots of things to back up this thing? I think don't say something unless you think it's genuinely like a valuable thing. If you're saying something to just be mean, I've realized that those people have probably got issues and got problems.
It's not nice to be them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I've managed to somehow find this place of compassion where I've realized that every single person saying something not very nice, there's no way that they're happy. There's no way that they're happy in themselves.
Should that compassion extend to climate deniers and, you know, people that push back, you know?
Yes, definitely. Because, look, if someone is a massive, big, fat climate change denier, you have to understand it's because they've been conditioned for whatever reason. And it's a protection thing. They're trying to protect themselves. And so there's always there's always a psychology behind people denying things.
What can the media do? Because our podcast is all about trying to get the most out of not just our industry, but anyone who's telling stories and doing comms around climate needs to step up and do it better. What could the media do to help you get your message out? Or what could it not do? How could it behave differently? How could it reform?
To help me get the message out?
Yeah. Oh.
Well, I mean, anytime if I'm wearing a bikini on a beach, that usually ends up being a, you know, Ellie Goulding on beach in bikini, instead of Ellie Goulding delivers speech at UN, you know, that's not interesting to people. So actually it's not the media's fault. It's whatever they've made people want to consume.
Could you hold a sign with the bikini, or
just write it on your belly?
But then look, but that's funny abs, and that's great content.
I mean, the belly area.
Yeah, God, that's
so
great. The belly area. That's so funny.
Like abdomen.
That is great content, you know. But
you said I was cool earlier. I think
you know what? Instead of being like that's hilarious, it would be like, oh, Ellie Goulding's gone mad. That would be it. It would be, oh, she's gone bonkers.
Troubled Ellie, yeah, writes climate message.
But then they'll be like, you're on a beach, you know, it would be instant, you're a hypocrite and all that
Yeah.
stuff.
I think...
she did it in Cornwall.
I think one thing...
Enjoying the climate change, Ellie, on the beach. That would be it.
So that charge of hypocrisy, that's the killer though, isn't it?
Yeah, but as I wrote down... and I think you know this quote as well, which is about, you know, climate hypocrisy or whatever. Okay, George Monbiot. Oh God. So summed it up, hypocrisy is the gap between your aspirations and your actions. Greens have high aspirations. They want to live more ethically and they will always fall short. The alternative to hypocrisy isn't moral purity, because no one can manage that, but cynicism. Give me hypocrisy any day.
Yes, hypocrisy is vastly underrated.
I think that is, and I love that quote. And just recognizing that, you know, just we're all going to fall short. Some people can try, and some people can just say, "Nah, you're falling short," and not do anything.
Mm-hmm. Look, even Lewis Hamilton drives, you know, Formula One cars. However, he's so brilliant on social media and doesn't care that posting things about the environment will lose him followers, and I really respect him for that.
Yeah.
When I first met him, he was meat eating, you know, didn't know anything about it, and now he's just so passionate about it. And yeah, he probably gets the odd private jet because he'd probably be very bothered on domestic airlines or whatever. And he's made a lot of money, and he's done insanely well in his career, and he's built it all by himself. But he posts so frequently, and he does a lot of work in his private life with charity work as well. That, look, I'd rather him do that than nothing. Mm. I'd rather big celebrities and big stars say something and still be a bit of a hypocrite. I'd rather that than nothing, personally.
Well, thank you, Ellie, for everything that you do and for speaking up and for raising your head above the parapet, which you really have
done.
There's
no going back now.
There isn't. That's it now. And thank you for being on So Hot right now with me and Tom.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been brilliant.
So we've heard from Ellie, who talks about what it's like to be the celebrity, but how do you get that celebrity? How do you twin somebody who cares about something with the opportunity to talk about it and make a difference? Well, there's actually a job for that, and we've got one of the people who does that job, Todd Krim, in the studio with us today.
Welcome, Todd. You're here from California.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. We met before, but we kind of met properly up a mountain in Davos. Mm-hmm. Would you like to just briefly explain what you were doing there?
Yeah, I was there with my client, Professor Gail Whiteman, a climate scientist who founded Arctic Base Camp, which is a group of climate scientists that camp out at Davos every year to bring attention to climate change. And with your support, we arranged for Ellie Goulding to visit the climate scientists up there and bring awareness to the world leaders of the dire consequences of climate change. And of course, this was even pre-Greta Thunberg phenomenon. And before, you know, this year, Everyone
she
was talking.
There.
She was there last year, yeah, but
That's
no one really knew who she was.
Her.
I know, me too. But, you know, Ellie's been doing this a long time, and it was cool that Ellie lent her voice to bring awareness to climate change last year when no one was really talking about it. Of course, this year everyone was talking about it.
Todd, what do you do?
Straight to the point.
Sure. Well, I'm basically a lawyer turned charity consultant. So a lot of people do think of me as a publicist, but I refer to myself as sort of a philanthropy consultant, bringing together the philanthropy and entertainment world. So I really help nonprofits and intergovernmental agencies leverage the entertainment industry to bring awareness to the important issues and causes that they work on.
Yeah, because like when I first met you and then I sort of looked you up online and there's just pictures of you with every celebrity, like really top, you know, Hollywood A-listers. And then the second time I saw you, you were in a sleeping bag at minus 18 having camped up a mountain in Davos with climate scientists. When I first met you, I didn't know that you would do that. Like, is it a shock to you to find yourself working with all these climate scientists?
No, not at all. I mean, I'll go anywhere to, you know, make a difference. So, you know, climate change is something I'm obviously very passionate about and is something I work on, but it's not the only issue I work on. I pretty much work on all the UN Sustainable Development Goals in one way or another and all the celebrities that care about those
issues.
So
why does somebody like the UN need someone like you?
Well, they need someone like me because, unfortunately, a lot of policymakers and decision makers aren't very good at educating the public on what they do and why they need to care about the issues that the UN works on, sadly.
You're being polite. I mean, they're terrible at it.
I am being polite.
They're absolutely terrible at it. So you basically come in and you are able to spot a story, essentially, that no one gave a shit about and didn't really travel and didn't get much traction, and you give it traction. Can you tell us, like, just some of your ingredients?
Yeah, what's the first thing you look at when you try and get a story and try and help it cut through?
I mean, my go-to is always, okay, what celebrity can we get that cares about this issue to talk about it? And in fact, even just today, Alfre Woodard, the actress, posted on her Instagram and tweeted about World NTD Day, which was actually yesterday, the first day, first of what will be an annual day dedicated to neglected tropical diseases.
I mean, that on paper would look like a really hard sell.
Yeah.
Right.
Neglected tropical diseases. Can you make that a thing? I mean, not a thing, it is a thing, but can you make that a story that's going to have traction?
Yeah. Well, what I can't say who, but I'm working with a major musical artist who is from a country that is disproportionately impacted by neglected tropical diseases. So we're going to bring him back to Africa to bring awareness to it. So like a concert. So again, it's kind of, yes.
Let's break this down because I need to get more. I need to get more understanding of what of squeeze these ingredients out. So that's one of the things that you do. You use celebrities. You're using people who are from different parts of the world. What are the other ingredients or opportunities that you would look for to apply to a story?
I mean, you need to make it sexy and cool and hip and popular. And you have to kind of. I'm all about kind of leveraging pop culture, basically. So I'm always thinking, what's going to make, you know, a millennial interested in reading about it? And it's going to be, I think the celebrity factor is one of it, but then part of it. But then also, I would say also maybe looking at it from a different angle or making it really relatable to anything with children. So and visual. So I would want to have that celebrity photographed or do a video of the celebrity interacting with a family impacted by neglected tropical diseases, for example.
So something that brings it home to people, puts a face to it,
Makes
it relevant to them.
Exactly.
Okay, can you help us? We had a series of challenges lined up for you, but actually you've already come in and said you're looking at neglected tropical diseases, which is probably harder than anything you can
really
see.
That's really hard, yeah.
But Tom's a millennial, so let's see if you can make this work for him.
I don't really think I'm on the borderline.
Okay, the Congo rainforest, okay?
Okay.
The second biggest rainforest in the world, and it is burning, or it has been burning, and it's released, tons of metric tons of carbon And it has, in a sense, been a huge story, like the Amazon inferno was a few months ago. But it hasn't been covered.
No one knows. My mum got really upset and phoned me about the Amazon rainforest burning. She has no idea that the Congo is also on fire.
Oh, okay.
How do you make my mum care about the Congo?
Todd is thinking. I can see the cogs whirring.
Yes. Well, I would, again, I'm going to think about celebrities that care about the Congo. And I know that there's a few. Rosario Dawson and Robin Wright. In fact, I think Robin has pajamas made by women in the Congo.
Sorry, just hold on. How do you know about Robin Wright's pajamas?
Because she told me.
Todd, you're like the fixer. You're like... what's he called in Pulp Fiction? You know, the Mr. Wolf. You know, that guy who comes in and just fixes stuff.
Yeah. No, I know. She makes some, I think Pour Le Fume is the name of the pajama line that's made by women in the Congo.
This is incredible knowledge.
Okay, right.
Okay, so they've got pajamas. Does your mum like pajamas? Is she interested in nighttime fashion?
I think she's more of a dressing gown and nighty kind of person, but we can work with that.
I asked you what your mum wears.
Sorry, I mean, Robin's issue is, you know, female empowerment, microfinancing for women entrepreneurs. But obviously, if the Congo's on fire, they're not able to work.
Right.
So you've gone straight for the gender thing, which is very, very important.
There's yeah, so maybe it's a combination week. Of gender and climate.
Well, there's a big story out this week about how climate disasters fuel violence.
Oh, yes,
women.
You're right. And I bet Robin would love to speak about that.
Yeah, because that story also, for my money, has not had enough traction either.
That's a good point. So we can kill two birds with one stone.
Let's not say kill.
We can nourish two birds with one stone.
Two birds with one stone. Yeah, like, so your job didn't really exist like about a decade ago, right? I mean, the work you just described is kind of a new thing. Why is it necessary?
The work being that Todd is essentially the environment needs a publicist.
Well, it depends. I mean, yes, I guess you could say in that sense, but again, I view my role, we're talking about climate, but I could do the same thing for gender-based violence, for HIV/AIDS, for example. I took Zendaya to South Africa in 2015 with UNAIDS to educate the public on the HIV/AIDS crisis. So climate is just one of, you know, many issues that are impacting the world right now. And what I do is I'm the middleman between the celebrities and the causes.
So big, scary problems that we have difficulty getting our heads around.
Yeah, human trafficking. I can find a celebrity or celebrities for that.
But they are all or often linked to climate crisis and climate disaster. And you would say that, wouldn't you, Tom? Some of these, but there's big issues that we see quite siloed, or we read about them in the press, they are actually...
That's true. At the root is climate.
Yeah, humans being forced to migrate because their crops are failing.
Yeah.
You know, people moving, people fighting, violent, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
All we want to do is do a better job. Essentially, this whole podcast is about us saying we want to do our jobs better as reporters and storytellers. Do you have, like, any final thoughts about, like, things that we should prioritize? How can we just be better, Todd?
Make it a human interest type story. I mean, obviously the default can always be make it a scary headline. but I think, secondly, I think make it a human interest story where you're walking someone through how this is really impacting someone's day-to-day life.
I really found that with the Australian bushfires. I found that no matter how many videos you watched of like thousands of acres burning, the images I remembered was the mother on the boat with the mask on, sheltering her kid, you know.
Yeah, so you got to kind of visually transport the reader into the heart of the story.
Visually transport the reader into the heart of the story. I love that.
Oh, and what do you think of our name, So Hot Right Now?
What is it? So Hot Right Now? Oh, I like it.
Yes. Okay, phew.
That's quite the seal of approval for Todd.
There was,
Todd,
like, there was quite a moment there as Todd sort of considered that. Thank you, Todd.
You're welcome.
His decision is final, by the way, so don't at us.
Sweet. So we have celebrities. We've been approved by a celebrity booker. This is going pretty well. But what's next, Lucy?
Next episode, we're going to get to grips with language with Damien Carrington, The Guardian's environment editor, and Gillian Burke,
natural history expert and Springwatch presenter. We're going to zero in on the words we use and why they matter so much.
This is a really interesting episode, and I think you'll probably find it quite surprising as well. Also, thank you very much for your lovely feedback. We got a nice message about how we're the nicest thing you can possibly go to a jog, do a jog, do a jog, have a jog, do a, done a jog, I done a jog. Anyway, go jogging.
You've done a jog.
I done a jog. Go,
we're talking about language next week.
Go jogging.
You're going to have to get yourself together.
There's a lovely podcast to go jogging while listening to. That's what somebody sent
me. My
God,
you made a meal out of that.
I did.
I didn't think people would go running to our podcast.
Or breastfeeding. But then, you know, we're breaking boundaries here. So,
and I'm so impressed by people's ability to multitask.
Mm-hmm. I can't even say one sentence at a time, it turns out.
It's early.
It is. So, yeah, please join us next week. Once again, thank you to Sony Fourth Floor and Picture Zero and our wonderful producer, Natalie Jameson. Ever patient producer, Natalie Jameson.
Thanks, Nat.
And, oh yeah, thank you, Lucy. That was great.
Thank you, Tom Mustel. Thank you so much. This is very polite.
This is so polite. And, yeah, thanks for listening, guys. You know, please keep sending in your thoughts and sending and subscribing and sharing the podcast.
Yeah, we'd like to get to 22 billion listeners pretty soon.
Yeah.
Like Ellie.
I think baby steps.